So we're good.
Tell me when we're rolling.
We are rolling. We are
All right.
rolling, and everybody just heard me say that. Okay, guys, I'm super excited. I have one of my, and I mean this sincerely, and Greg knows it, but you know, he is somebody I have revered. I'm kind of like amazed that we're friends now because I would be buy every one of your books, do every single thing you ever did since the day you started writing books. And you have become somebody I know you've stayed in my home, and my husband and I both just think you're such a special human being. And I am so happy that you agreed to do this with me. So this is our Real and Raw series. Everybody see Greg in his fabulous office, and I mean, and we're going to have the best conversation today. So real and raw just means we're going to be real and raw. We're going to talk about the things that mean something to us, and we're really going to talk about a big topic about the nature of personal reality. And Greg is literally the person who I would say, there he went. He, oh, don't go away.
I'm sorry.
Between you and Michael Talbot, I've got to say, Michael Talbot, who wrote The Holographic Universe,
Sure.
you guys were probably the most important influences in my life to bridge science and spirituality, because I'm a complete science geek. So, and now, because the world is so uncertain, and of course, this is for all the people that are my book launch, my book is called Uncharted: The Journey Through Uncertainty into Infinite Possibility. And you are that man to talk about this. And so I'm so happy. I'm just going to shut up now. So I'm going to ask you some questions and we're just going to riff.
Well, first, I'm just going to say hi. It's so great to see you. It's an honor to be with you today. Can I just share with our audience a little bit? We had some tech issues. Can I talk about
Oh,
that?
yeah.
So for some, we live. My wife and I live in a rural area in northern New Mexico. This is raw, right? So I can talk
Yeah,
about
real
this, right?
raw.
Okay. So we live in a rural area in northern New Mexico. We don't have the best Wi-Fi, the best internet, and we're having problems getting on this morning. So I'm working on a little iPad that I retired years ago, but it's that old iPad technology. And to get this to where it needs to be, it's sitting up on my guitar stool, and it's sitting up on top of a couple of books. And the book on the bottom is all about the secrets of Hebrew words because it was a nice thick hardback book.
Yeah.
And up on top to keep it from moving, there's another two hardback books. There's the History of the World and another Torah. So we're
Wow.
like sandwiched in between all of this ancient sacred stuff.
And we have this, and of course, that's exactly the way I want to play this today, because it's about the world as it is raw and real, and it's also about the sacred understandings that have existed since the beginning of time, and the science that's now giving it legs in our modern world. So the first thing I want to ask you, and I'll make it with a statement. Like, I believe, and I've certainly been downloaded enough from my guides and from what I've experienced as a medium and as an intuitive, that the world that we live in, that the primary reality is not the material world. Our primary reality is that of spirit and mind. So, what do you have to say about that, Greg?
Well, I think intuitively, I think we all sense the same thing from the time that we were young, Colette. We as children, we perceive the world very differently than the adults around us. We see things, we hear things, we interact with the world in a way that people around us as adults, sometimes it doesn't make sense to them because we are actually in tune with what you're saying. We are experiencing one facet of a reality, and there are many other realities around us. And our senses, our five senses, when we're born into this world, we're able to perceive all of these realities. And what happens as we mature among the people, our caregivers, our family, and our friends, and our religious upbringings, and schools, and all the ways that we're taught to see the world. What happens is many of the perceptual abilities become dormant. Now, I don't
Right.
want to say that we lose them
No, I agree.
because,
They're dormant.
yeah, they're always there, but they're dormant. So we sense this intuitively.
Yeah.
The best minds of our time tell us precisely the same thing. You know, in 2008, which didn't seem that long ago until I'm thinking it's like 8 years ago
I
now,
know.
Yeah, 2008, we lost one of the great pioneers in physics. Well, we lost a couple of the great pioneers in physics that were helping us to navigate this bridge between the world that we know today and what we've been led to believe and what science is now telling us. What we're beginning to understand, Colette, is that I'm just going to start at the very basics. I wrote a book in 2007 called The Divine Matrix.
I know. It's one of my favorite books. I've read it 8 times.
Oh, I'm honored. Thank you. You know, it actually was a textbook in the physics course in your country, in Calgary, Canada.
Wow.
2 summers ago. It was a pilot program.
Wow.
The key to The Divine Matrix was the scientific validation of the fact that there is a field that connects all things, a field of energy. Okay, now you and I, our audience, we say, okay, what's the big deal? You know, we have sensed that all of our lives. It's a big deal for science. Now, I want to start. Can I just lay out some basics, and then we can tie into these as we go through the program?
You are my hero,
as we go through the program, listen to me.
Yes, let's go through a program. It's good. We're given a program.
Here's the thing. In the late 1800s, there was a tremendous spiritual revolution that was sweeping the earth. It was sweeping the world of science. And there was a huge rift in the scientific community as to whether or not there is a field of energy that connects all things because of the implications. And I'm going to talk about those implications. But the idea was there were many scientists that said the field doesn't exist, and others that say said at that time that it did. So in 1887, in the basement of Case Western Reserve Western University. There was a very famous experiment that was conducted, and it was called the Michelson-Morley experiment. And the purpose of this experiment was to prove once and for all whether or not this field of energy exists. If it does, then we can incorporate it into our beliefs, into our physics, into the way things work. If it doesn't, we'll let it go. So let me just here's the experiment. I'm just going to give an equivalent. If we all walked out of our homes right now, and we moistened our index finger, and we placed it above our head. And the moment we did that, if we felt no wind against our finger, okay, if we felt no wind, and from that, we concluded no air exists in the world.
Right.
Okay. That is the equivalent of the Michelson-Morley experiment. And, of course, we know just because there's no wind in that instant doesn't mean
there's no air.
Of course it does.
Right.
They said if this field is out there, the field is moving, so we should be able to detect it. They did not detect it in 1887.
Right.
So this is what's so amazing to me. From 1887, for 100 years, the science that put humans on the moon, that understands DNA, that understands how to split the atom, as good as that science is, it's incomplete because it's based in the idea that everything is separate from everything else.
Is this called materialist science?
It's called mechanical science. Materialist science. You can call it Newtonian physics.
Okay.
So here's what happened. In 1987, 100 years later, this experiment was repeated under the auspices of the United States Air Force, which I think is really interesting if they would be, you know, exploring these things. But they've got really good equipment. So with much better equipment, 100 years later, they did precisely the same experiment. Colette, I'm just blown away by the results because not only did they detect the field just as it was predicted 100 years earlier by Michelson and Morley, but the field actually exists within the same range of parameters that were projected hypothesized 100 years earlier. They just didn't have the equipment. They were men and women ahead of their time. They didn't have the equipment to measure it. So the bottom line, since 1987, scientists now have known that there is a field of energy that connects all things, and they're struggling to reconcile this fact into the science now that has brought us into the 21st century. It's still not taught in mainstream classrooms and textbooks. But here's why I wanted to lay this out right now, because the field fulfills three purposes. It is a mirror. This is the stuff upon which all of our quantum projections are being experienced. It's the mirror for all things in the world. It is a bridge between us and the world out there. And we say, okay, if I'm creating a prayer in my heart? How does that prayer get to my loved ones halfway around the world on the battlefield of Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. It means there has to be something for that prayer to move through, some
right.
medium. And it is this stuff. So it is the container
right.
within which all reality that we will ever know unfolds. Everything that we can experience in this realm, in this dimension, in any realm, in any dimension, is unfolding within the container of this field. Now, we don't know what's beyond the container, but the science says the container is the ultimate vessel for all things. So this field, it's the container for all things. It is the mirror for our inner experiences
right.
to be in the world around us, and it is the bridge between us and our outer world. Once we get that, all of a sudden, so many of our most cherished and ancient spiritual and indigenous traditions and some of the new thought
ideas, makes sense. Oh,
they begin to make sense. Mm-hmm. I want to be really clear here. I'm a scientist.
Yeah.
Science is good. Science does not have all the answers. I'm also a realist. I'm open-minded.
Yep.
There are a lot of new thought ideas that are good. And I got to tell you, there are a lot of new thought ideas that are so far out there. They're not based in reality. They're not based in truth. And for me, it's a waste of time
right.
to embrace things that simply aren't true. So that's why I think the science, and especially when it comes to healing, Colette, when we're
yes.
talking about the lives of our friends or loved ones or maybe our own lives, to put our time and energy into beliefs and ideas that are not valid, that aren't true.
Right, I get it. Yep,
get it. It's an interesting thing to do. So this is, for me, why the language and the path of science has been important, because the science can validate.
Yep, me too.
once we have that, we're going places where science hasn't caught up yet.
Right.
But our ancestors have, and I'm really open to that. So I just wanted to lay this out as we're going through this, because what we just said is the key to any conversation that you and I could possibly have today and anything that's happening in the world.
Just out of curiosity, did you sign the manifesto for post-materialist science? Are you one of those?
Yeah, I signed
that. I'm obsessed with that. So just for the people who are going to be watching this, right, this is science is crucial, and I feel that science, as it evolves now, when you add consciousness to the mix, which we'll get to in a second, but when we start to add that field, because the field it's a conscious universe, right? We can then see, we actually have almost like a mathematical grid or right? It's like A plus B equals C, or A plus B sometimes equals G and E and F at the same time. but we can actually see these things. And you know, the reason why I became so obsessed with it is because I had so many strange experiences with no context for it. You know, so many right abilities for me to know something that's happening to somebody on the other side of the planet. But anyway, I don't want to digress at all. This is your talk. So where I would love to see us go now with this is, if we were to look at the field then, and that's what I call spirit. That's my word for it, because I come
sure.
from, go ahead.
No, Don, I'm disagreeing with you.
Yeah, so you're agreeing. Yeah, so like when you did the divine matrix, so that's another name for it. So I say spirit, not meaning any kind of a white guy, God in the sky, that's like Santa Claus deciding if you're good or bad. I believe that the universe is impersonal. And that, right? I mean, that's what I believe, right? And I've seen this, that is why your work is so key, so important right now, because you have directed so many of us through your exercises, your research, your findings, all the latest stuff, to be able to like do protocols. Like, for example, that heart, I do that every day, and I'm actually teaching that in my workshop. It comes from you, where I learned it first, that the heart exercise, where you plug into the heart every 20 minutes, we're doing it for 3 minutes.
Wow.
People get completely kazooed. But anyway, back to the field, back to consciousness, back to all this.
Well, sure. So now we know that there is a field that connects
yes.
all things. And that is that it's changed everything. And I just want to say a word about science. And I mentioned I'm a scientist. I'm an earth scientist. I'm a geologist by degree. With a background in physics and computer science and ocean science and some other science, computer science, I think I said that. It all works together. Science is good. Science in our lifetimes, call it. I'm just going to, because this is raw and unplugged,
raw.
I'm going to say it straight up. Science has been hijacked.
Yeah.
In our lifetimes, It's been hijacked by corporations, yep. by politics, by religion,
yep.
and in some cases by the new thought industry to justify agendas that simply are not true as we know them today. So we have to be really, really careful about how we use the science and how it's applied. And for that reason, when I'm sharing these discoveries, I'm sharing what are called peer-reviewed discoveries.
Yes, yes.
Peer-reviewed means that the studies are done by scientists that publish and circulate their discoveries among their peers, thus peer-reviewed.
Right. Yep.
And it can take years. It can take 6, 7, 8 years for a paper to circulate through all of these peer review groups, and they will rake it through a fine-tooth comb. I mean, they'll try to shoot holes and find out what's wrong or support what's right, and then it's published in the mainstream journals as peer-reviewed science, and it's accepted as fact. That's
right.
different,
yeah.
for example, than a scientist, and I get this all the time. A scientist that I'll get something on the internet says, NASA scientist predicts blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Well, you look into it. Is the guy a scientist? Yes. Does he work at NASA? Yeah. And in his leisure on the weekends, he's home on the internet writing about things that he believes, but he's not doing it under the auspices of NASA.
Right.
But when you get that paper,
right. you think that's NASA.
It looks like fact, and it hasn't been through the peer-reviewed process. So when I say to you, I'm just going to speak to our listeners. Listeners, when I say to you, it's a fact that this field exists as peer-reviewed science. It was discovered and published in the very prestigious journal Nature, a man named Silvertooth, 1987. They called it special relativity so they could even get it published.
Right.
But what it means is this field is out there. The field has many names. I called it the Divine Matrix.
Yep.
Max Planck called it the Matrix, 1944. Yep. He said there's a matrix that underlies everything that we see. And this is how we began this conversation. There's a matrix of energy. From our perspective, we can't see over the horizon of the matrix right. to see the other realities. But he said this was here. Some people call this field simply the field. Lynn McTaggart.
Lynn McTaggart, another one of my faves.
Dear friend, I just spent a week with her last week.
Yeah.
A leadership conference. She wrote a book called The Field.
I know. This brilliant book.
So there are the quantum field is another yeah. name for it. The God field and or God or spirit.
Yep.
There are many different names. Now, I'm just saying this because it means a little something different to everyone. But I agree, Colette, the field appears to be impersonal. And what that means is, this is where I go back to, yep. it is a container, a mirror, and a bridge.
Yep.
The mirror doesn't lie.
No,
so
that's right.
The field doesn't reflect to us what it wants us to see so that we feel good. The field reflects what is true in our lives or in our world, individually or collectively, in the moment. And our role is to be able to recognize that, number one,
yep.
And embrace what this field is actually saying to us so that we can apply it in our lives, become better people, and create a stronger families, stronger communities, create a better world. Yeah.
Oh, this is so exciting. So if we use that as our starting point, for example, and
okay.
we believe, and so say that this field, so it's a container, it's a mirror, and it's a bridge.
Right.
But what about its being conscious?
Consciousness is, from this perspective, everything in the field is consciousness.
It's consciousness.
Okay. And there's nothing that is not some level of consciousness. And we
right.
tend to think, or the Western world is tended to identify consciousness with humans or
yeah.
with only living things. But
yeah.
when I, with my native friends, a yeah. rock has consciousness.
Oh, yeah. I know that. I know that intimately.
Yeah. It's a different kind of consciousness. But everything is conscious from this perspective. And we have the ability to communicate with yeah. all of these different levels of consciousness. So I'm a scholar as well. I think you know that.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that I found so interesting, Colette, is when this is back in the late 70s, early 1980s, I wanted to see how our most ancient and cherished traditions viewed prayer. What did
right.
prayer mean to them? And what I found, Colette, is the word prayer does not even exist. in our most ancient and cherished spiritual traditions. It doesn't exist in the Christian traditions, in the Hebrew traditions, certainly not the native traditions, any of these. There is another word that is used that was translated into the word prayer. So you've heard that things get lost in the translation.
Yeah, lost in translation.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, this is exactly what happened. And listen to this word. It is so powerful. It is so beautiful. It is so perfect. The word that is used in place of prayer is the word communion.
Oh.
So our ancestors, yes, when they talked about us interacting with the forces of nature, with the elements of the world, they said that we were in communion with the sun. We're in communion with the earth. That is a whole, I just got goosebumps.
That's a whole other thing.
Because when we say prayer, it doesn't have to be, but it generally, we sense it as an experience of what's called supplication.
I was about to say that, yep.
Where we feel that we are powerless.
And we're separate.
And we need to ask for help, intervention. You know, dear God.
Yep.
I have a friend when I was living in San Francisco. Every Friday night, my friend said the same prayer on the 680 freeway. Dear God, if you let my car get to the Conoco station at the bottom of the 680, I'll never let my gas tank get this low again. Okay, that's a prayer of supplication where you feel powerless and you say, I need some help here. And then the same prayer would happen the next Friday, because my friend always did that.
Right.
But that's a whole different feeling than knowing that we are in communion, that there is a two-way experience happening with the elements of nature. And what I found is there's a lot of resistance around this in the mainstream and again, in mainstream science.
And mainstream religion. Because there really is, again, you know, there's this idea that we have to be somehow distanced from or separate from a deity, like God is one deity, right? For example, it depends if it's monotheism or polytheism, there's still us and it, or us and some big major. And there's a sense that, like, certainly for me, I remember when I first got sober and what happened to me, which was a moment of communion. When I went up from the drug dealer's basement, I hadn't bathed or slept for a week. I should be dead at this point. This is over 30 years ago because I've been clean and sober now over 30 years.
Wow, and I'll never forget.
And that whole concept of addiction is that you are so separate and it is so much about that, you know, this. And when I couldn't take it anymore and I was going to die, I completely surrendered, and when I held the side of this dirty sink and I said, help me, it was different than come get me and I'll never do it again. It was a communion that happened where I surrendered and gave myself over fully, consciously, to whatever was. I had no clue who I was saying that to. It was to the life force, and the field literally mirrored it right back at me. And I literally, it was as if I was ushered into a brand new world. It was, even my eyesight changed. It was incredible. And those moments, now, unfortunately, that was like when we hit bottom, and we lose the separation piece where the ego self can no longer identify or define ourselves so much. And I think that's a huge piece right now with, again, the amount of uncertainty in the world. And you shared about this in your latest book. You know, these are hugely changing times, right? And we have to find ways of learning to thrive in spite of all of this. And I think it's this sense of separation that is causing us also more and more to buy into more, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm
writing about it right now. I'm actually working on another book, and this, what we're saying right now, it goes back 2010. I released a book. It was called Deep Truth, and the whole premise of Deep Truth is that we live our lives, we choose our relationships, we heal our bodies. We think of ourselves, our self-esteem, the jobs that we're worthy of, the careers we're worthy of, the people in our lives that we're worthy of sharing time with. All of that is based upon a story that we are told from the time that we are young. We live our lives based upon the way we think about ourselves. What's happened is new discoveries have overturned 150 years of scientific thinking, and they're telling us the story that we were taught is incomplete in many respects. It's flat out wrong in other respects. The bottom line is that we've been steeped in a story of separation.
Yep.
We're told that we're separate from our bodies, that we're separate from the earth, that we're separate from the cosmos, that we're separate from one another, and that we live in the world based upon competition and conflict.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
And if you want to know how much influence that has had in our lives, the world around us is based upon these ideas. The economic system is based upon competition and conflict. Our medical system, the way we're taught to address and heal our bodies, is based upon separation, all of these things. So if you want to see what these ideas look like when they're put into play, it's the world that we have now. It's a world that is buckling and collapsing because it's based upon an unsustainable belief system of separation and competition and conflict. The good news, the new discoveries have overturned all of that.
Yeah.
And now they're telling us that we are literally, we live in a world, we are connected to our bodies, deeply connected to our bodies, thoughts, feelings, emotions, beliefs in our heart and our brain change the chemistry in our bodies. And we choose the thoughts, feelings, emotions, and beliefs. So we actually have tremendous ability to influence what's happening in our bodies. The same principles now are true beyond our bodies because this field exists. And the kicker is that we now know that nature is based upon a model of cooperation and mutual aid, not competition and conflict. This is another place, call that, where rather than an individual hitting rock bottom, I think the earth is hitting rock bottom. And what we're seeing is that the ways that we have been taught to think and solve our problems, whether we're talking about terrorism and ISIS in the Middle East or the global economy, or we're talking about the epidemics of Alzheimer's and cancers that are we've never seen at this level before. We're talking about the destruction of vital resources that we simply cannot live without, like fresh water. Yeah. All of that's Earth hitting rock bottom. Mm-hmm. So when we hit rock bottom, that's typically when we are open, more open to new ideas. The good news is the ideas. We already have all the solutions, and we now know that all the technological solutions. And science has now given us the discoveries that overturn 150 years of a false scientific narrative. We know that we live in a world of connection, cooperation, and mutual aid, and that changes everything. Yep. It changes everything. But I think it's – people ask me all the time. They say, Greg, if we know this, how come it's not being taught in my kids' schools? You know, or why don't we see it in the mainstream media, on the History Channel, Discovery Channel? Why is it in the textbooks? This is a perfect example of where the science – not only the science has been hijacked, but there is habit, ego, money – are primary reasons. I have friends in the academic world right now, teaching in universities. They're my friends until we have this conversation, and then we don't talk for a while. I'll ask them. I'll say, why can't you share these discoveries with your students? I'll just give you an example. Evolution. We now know that evolution, it's a fact for some forms of life. As a geologist, I've seen it in the fossil record for plants and animals. When it comes to humans, the idea of evolution breaks down. It falls apart. The evidence does not support the data. And especially when we get to human DNA, what happened with our DNA is not the product of an evolutionary process. That's a whole separate conversation.
Oh, I want to have that one.
So I talk to my academic professor friends, and I say, why can't you teach this? It's based on peer-reviewed science. This is genetics that's happening in the Los Alamos National Labs. It's peer-reviewed. And they said, Greg, you don't understand. They said, and I'll just give you one friend of mine. He said, if I were to teach this in the classroom, it would invalidate my 40-year career of teaching anthropology. And I'd say, no. I said, just the opposite. Science is designed to be constantly updated.
It's supposed to.
Would show your students how viable science is. And I'm not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater. Go ahead and teach the old stuff. Teach the new stuff right alongside and let our young people have the benefit of everything that we know so they can make the decisions themselves. So then he said, it'd be too expensive to change the textbooks. I said, not a problem. I said, you know what? Textbooks are on computers now. You change it on a master file and it's changed everywhere. And then he said, okay, habit. He said, I would have to go back and change my curricula for 40 years of teaching. And I said, that's what they're paying you to do. You're a teacher, you know? So, but it's this thinking. We are living a generation that is turn everything is upside down. And because it's all up for grabs right now, we all know, even the skeptics know something is up. Yep. Whether you're looking at the big world or you're looking at your personal life, something's up. Something's not business as usual. And when we go to look at the way we've solved our problems in the past, they're not working. And we're seeing them not work. We're seeing it in the Middle East. We're seeing it with terrorism. You know, we're seeing it with the economy, all the things that I mentioned. So the good news is we can let those old ideas go. They served us so well that they got us here. You have to say they served us because we're here today. Mm-hmm. The world changed. They can no longer serve us in this environment. Mm-hmm. So bless those ideas. Mourn the passing of the life that we have known, the world that we have known, the belief systems that we know. It's the mourning. When we mourn the passing of those ideas, that's what frees us, Colette, to let them go. It's hard to embrace a new idea
when we're holding on to the old one.
Exactly. In our mind, consciously, subconsciously, if we're hanging on to an idea. A perfect example. This is election year in the States. I think everybody knows that. We have politicians out there promising that our economy can get, quote, back on track. That our climate can go back to where it was 20 years ago. It's impossible to go back to a world that no longer exists.
Yes,
the climate of 20 years ago no longer exists in our lifetime. The economy, we now are we live in a globally connected world that wasn't so 20 years ago. We cannot go back to that world because it doesn't exist. Mm. So the same thing is happening as people witness the breakdown of the security that we've known in the past. If they don't know there's something else there, it's scary. It's frightening. Yeah. And I get it. And when we can step back and look at the big picture and we begin to see, number one, the world is changing because of where we are in natural rhythms and cycles that our traditions don't talk about, but indigenous cultures do, ancient traditions did, and many other cultures do today. It's just the Western society doesn't talk about them. When you can see those cycles converging in our lifetime, this little switch goes off. You say, my God, no wonder the world is looks like it's crazy. I mean, look at what's going on. So now you can let go. It's not that something is broken. No. It's that we're living this rare, precious moment of change that we've never seen, and our parents didn't see, and we don't have a good guidebook. So the things you're talking about right now are the keys to embracing change in a healthy way in the new world, the things you're talking about, your new book, that is the guidebook that we need to help guide us through the changes in our lives. It allows us to mourn. And when I say mourn, it doesn't have to be a big, sad ceremony.
No,
it's simply, it's just the acknowledgement
that things are going to change. And you know, the reason I called my book Uncharted was because everything is new. We cannot go back to the familiar, and that it's the scary part. I think about when Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom, right, where he was being chased, and he had the edge of a cliff, and he looked down, and all he saw was an edge of a cliff, but he trusted.
I know this scene. I know right where you're going with this scene.
Right? And that's the scene I talk about in my book. We're all there, just like him.
Walked across the chasm.
Because it came up, because he took one step. It's like what Joseph Campbell said, the mythologist. You take one step towards the gods, they will take 10 steps towards you. So it's like he had to take a step into this unknown, but he had faith that something was going to come. He didn't know what kind of path. He just figured, I know there's something here in the invisible. And I'm going to step with faith. And he did. And it went right. And a bridge came.
He did. But he had the faith based on a knowing.
Yes.
A greater context. He was exploring an ancient mystery.
Yes.
That was held by the Knights Templar that was on the cave on the other side. So he had already experienced the mysterious.
Right.
And learned to come to trust himself.
Yes.
And that's different than having no experience, no trust, and simply walking off a cliff. There's
a big difference.
And subtle difference there.
Yeah. Well, it's not subtle.
Colette, so we're on Unplugged, and I'll share something with you. And you and I have never had this conversation. You talked about hitting rock bottom when you were whatever age, you know, you
27.
Were. I never had that kind of experience, but I had a very different experience. And I think you and many of our viewers know I come from a very dysfunctional family. born and raised in the upper Midwest, late 40s and early 50s. My father was alcoholic. My mother and my brother and I got the bad end of that. And I, life was painful for me at a very early age. When I was 5 years old is when I had my first mystical experience that told me there's more to this world and more to this life, and that my life could be lived in a different way. And I don't share this very much, but I'll share with you what I did. And I don't remember this being conscious. Like I woke up one morning and said, this is the day I'm going to do this thing. But what I did, I took an electrical wire that was attached to an appliance, and I cut it off the appliance. And you know, there's two wires there. Yeah. There's a hot and a ground. I separated them. I stripped the insulation off both, and I walked over to a wall plug on our living room porch, and I plugged one wire on one side and one wire on the other side and held on for dear life. It burned me. It burned my hands. It burned all my eyebrows, my eyelashes off. My arms were burned. I couldn't talk. I was in shock. My mom found me, and she placed me. This is in broad daylight. She placed me in a bed in my room in broad daylight. So it wasn't a nighttime experience, and she left the room to call the doctor. In those days, the doctor would still come to the house. And while she was gone, in my room was the first time that I had the opportunity to see, to glimpse into another world. My sticking those wires into that wall plug, and I'm not suggesting or recommending this.
No. But don't I'm do saying, this at home. No, no.
It literally shocked me into a different reality. Right. And there were two beings in the room with me. One, and they had dark maroon robes. One was at my feet and one was behind my head, which was really interesting because my headboard was up against a solid wall. Wow. So this being was behind me. And I remember looking back just like this, and they were just as real as you and me right now. And they told me that I would be okay. They said they assured, I thought I was going to die. And they assured me that I was going to be okay. And they told me to remember the feeling that I was having in that moment. And that feeling has been with me. I can access that feeling. That was my point of reference.
Yep.
When I go into a prayer, when I want to go into a deep knowing of myself, when I want to commune, not pray, but commune with a wisdom beyond my local immediate body, I have that feeling to this day. And that was what taught me that there's something else, more to this world, and that the pain that I was living at that point in my life, it wouldn't be my pain for the rest of my life, that there was a way that I could heal that pain within my life. And as soon as I was old enough, I left home. I turned to rock and roll music.
Oh, I did. We both have
We do. I began, I was too young, I was 14 years old by this time when I was in my first band, and I left my home and moved in, which is illegal now, but I moved in with my band to get out of my, you know, the family environment. It was illegal for me. They had to smuggle me into a bar and let me play my guitar and then smuggle me back out because I wasn't old enough to be in the bar in those days. But that was my, it was a different kind of rock bottom, but I didn't want to be in this world. It hurt to be in this world. And that experience literally shocked me into a way of seeing.
Let's talk about that way of seeing.
Inform me, yeah.
Let's talk about that because I feel it's my duty or it's my mission to help people get to that space without sticking their finger in the electric.
I was just saying, don't do the wall plug thing. Well, we don't need to. We don't need to.
No, and I know that that is my mission. That's my work because you can no longer look to the outer conditions to show you whether you're safe or not. You have to find a way to access a different dimension of consciousness. Even if it's a glimpse, it will change you forever. And once you know where that almost a psychic geography is in a way, right? It's this sense of periphery, a peripheral way. You then can touch that as a touchstone and you can be like Indiana Jones and step there. But it's the mystical piece that we have lost because science, education, and religion have all been hijacked. And so this, right, this concept of we can show this unity, because you actually had a taste of that, as did I on a number of occasions. But anyway, you were about to say something. about.
Well, I'm agreeing. I'm nodding and agreeing with you, and because you know we're totally in sync right here.
Yeah.
It's what I call a spiritual anchor.
Yeah.
I was fortunate in that I learned early on that I had a spiritual anchor. Once we find that in our lives, Colette, and it comes about in different ways for different people.
Yeah.
But my belief is, my sense is that each individual in our own ways, we must find that spiritual anchor. Once we have that, and it is so solid, rock solid in our lives, what's happening in the world around us takes on a different significance. We're no longer afraid to leave a job and try a different job, or leave something that's familiar and try something new, or move from where you were born and raised, you know, halfway around the world. Or, you know, we're not afraid because we know no matter what we experiment with in this sensual world, we're okay. We're always going to be okay. If we don't have that spiritual anchor, we place our trust and our security in the things around us that we have accumulated in our lives. We'll place, and you see this, a perfect example, and statistics bear this out beautifully. In the Western world, when people retire, many people, they so identify with job that they do, that they've lost their own identity. So when they retire, when they no longer get up and go to that job every day, the statistics of them dying within 90 days or 6 months after that are high. And you say, well, what happened? And you talk to their loved ones, and they were just lost. Mm-hmm. They were just lost. You can do an experiment. Next time you're at a family gathering, I'm all of our viewers here, and you haven't, or you're meeting somebody new, if you ask someone, who are you? Say, well, who are you? What they will tell you is what they do. Mm-hmm. They will tell you, I am what I do.
Yeah.
And then if you try to hone in on that and say, well, you know, I understand that's what you do for a living, but
who are you?
You know, really, who are you? How do you see yourself? They'll either walk away or they'll look stunned because it's something that they typically haven't thought about. If it's where we place the anchor of our identity,
an exercise I'm doing in my workshop, Uncharted. I have a weekend workshop. That is actually one of the exercises that we do. It's just to, and then to ask ourselves that, like, who am I? Like, we just to, and what, in what, in what order do we place it? And then we move things around because, there's something about that sense of identity as being in the material world, right? I mean, being very identified with the things we have, and we are trained for that. We are completely hypnotized that sure. should be the way we are.
Well, we are, and the fact is we are here. This is why we are so unique, Colette. No other form of life is trying to do what we are trying to do. And literally, I wrote a book in 1997 called Walking Between the Worlds, and it is us walking between the worlds. We do need to have a focus, and we do need to master the realities that we find ourselves in. The key is to do it without losing ourselves in that world. How do we master the material world without getting lost in that world? And I think what we're seeing today, so many people, and a lot of young people, I see this especially, are really struggling with this. I'm seeing two things in young people. I have no children of my own, so I am involved with young people in some of the focus groups and, you know, things that we do, the seminars we do. There are some young people that are so optimistic of the new world. The world that we're living in right now makes no sense to them. They don't care about the stock market. They don't care about the border between Mexico and America, you know, because it doesn't make any sense to them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense to, if you really think about it, you know, a lot of it doesn't make any sense. And then there's another group of young people that feel so lost.
Yeah.
And they, because they don't trust in the future, they don't trust in their own lives. They live their lives each day, and they do things to their bodies each day that make sense only in the moment, because they're not thinking about how it's going to, you know, is this going to hurt me 20 years from now?
Right.
If you ask them, they'll say they're not even going to be here 20 years from now. So why worry about it?
Yeah.
You know, so those two things are both of those things are happening. But The new book, this is perfect. We're having this conversation. I'm writing about a lot of this in my book. I'm pointing this way.
Yeah, I know. You're going this way.
Well, my office is divided into two spaces. This is my inspirational space. So I have in here, this is my yoga room. It is also, I have an entire music studio over here with all my guitars and everything set up. And in there is another room that is where I sit down with the computers and do the writing. So I'm writing about this now. The world that we see, the struggle that's happening, it is a generational struggle. And I personally believe, Colette, it is a struggle based upon the false assumptions that we have embraced in our lives. The feeling that we are separate from ourselves, from one another. We've lost respect for life.
Yep.
We've lost respect for the sanctity of life. People that respect life don't treat other people the way that we're seeing happen all over the world, or even with young people in our own backyard when it comes to drugs or it comes to alcohol or it comes to physical abuse or any of those things. When we love and respect something, we don't treat that something in this manner. So I think we have lost a lot of that because academia and the Western world has chosen to embrace this path that we're materialistic, that we are placeable, that we are separate from one another, we're separate from our world.
There's not enough.
Exactly. And as we embrace, so this is why I'm excited right now. We have an entire generation right now that's poised to receive a new reality. What would happen if we could steep a new generation in the peer-reviewed science that says you are a precious, special being in this world? You're not the result of a random biological fluke. You are here because of an intentional process, and your DNA tells us that. I mean, you don't have to say that to the kids, but what you're saying is you're special, okay? You are deeply connected to your own body. You're deeply connected to the world around you, and you live in a world where nature is based in cooperation and likes you. Nature is not something you need to defend yourself against and shield yourself from. The very elements that create your body are not your enemy. If we could raise an entire generation of young people in those beliefs, that is where the events that we're seeing in our lives, ultimately, that's where it's got to turn around. It's got to turn around with the thinking of the young people.
Right.
We could have military solutions that are temporary. We can have economic solutions that are imposed. But the true change has to come from within, from a new way of thinking and seeing ourselves in relationship to the world. And we now have the science, the best science of the 21st century, is now come full circle and parallels our most cherished and ancient spiritual traditions, telling us, giving us the reasons to embrace these ideas. So I think this is where we are going ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we are the generation. There has to be a generation that makes the shift. That there has to be a generation that is strong enough, that has the spiritual and the emotional strength to stand in one place on this earth in this lifetime and say, yes, I know where I've been, and I know that it has served me, and I'm going to let it go. And from this point forward, I know what's possible. I know who I am, and I'm embracing. I mean, you think about that. It takes somewhere, someone has to make that choice.
Can you imagine if we were kids? And I was fortunate because my father taught my sister and I. My father was good friends with Eric von Däniken, so it was chariots.
Oh, wow.
So he actually told us when we were little kids that we were engineered, that we were here, that human beings were brought here by aliens. That's what my dad said, right? So that it was possible, that it was possible that the theory of evolution was inaccurate. That he didn't say for sure, he just said it was possible. This was a hypothesis of Eric von Däniken, right? So everybody knows about him. He was one of the first authors in the 60s that wrote about the structures at the top of the Andes Mountains that look like runways, etc. So if we were in school and taught that we are connected in by this field of energy that would reflect back to us, be the container of our thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, and be a container of our life, a container of everything that we see, that from the invisible reflects back to us our dominant energy and our truth, our deepest truth, right? Will we reflect back to us so that we can shift it and change it if we don't like what we see, right? And that we could bridge to other worlds, not just one another within this world, because there are other dimensions of consciousness. Can you not imagine that the world would be completely different?
Well, it would happen overnight. I mean, once an idea like that is embraced, and you know, I mean, the idea is it. What you're talking about in this conversation, the things we're describing, it's already in consciousness,
yes.
And that's where it shows up in the movies.
That's
so you
right.
know, where
like
do the ideas
Matrix.
In the movies? You know, the Matrix. Our dear friend and colleague Bruce Lipton. You know, I toured
yes.
Europe with Bruce on the train a couple of years ago, and I remember on the train we were sitting there and. And we were having this conversation, and he said, you know, a lot of people think the movie The Matrix is science fiction. He says it's actually a documentary.
Right.
I love that.
I love that you said that, because that's how I feel.
I want to share something that's really interesting. I was with I did a program not long ago in Washington, D.C., and you never know who's going to come to your Washington,
right.
D.C. programs. And during a break, a man in a dark suit, with very shiny shoes came up to me and I looked at him and I said, are you going to stay? Are you going to come back after the break? And he said, I am. I said, well, why are you here? And this is what he said to me. This is so interesting. He said, there was a time that we, whoever we is, we thought we understood, we had a handle on what was changing in the world. He said, and this is his language, he said, something has gone awry. Something has gone horribly awry, and that's the reason I'm here. I want to see your take on what's happening in the world today. And I said, well, my take is this. What others have thought was an orderly shift in the world, whatever that means, wherever it's going, what was never factored in was consciousness.
Right,
consciousness
right.
was taken seriously enough to
yeah.
be factored in. And when we factor in human consciousness into everything else that's happening, it can't be predicted, and it's not linear like mm-hmm. the models show. You know, the models showing us moving toward a one world. We already have a one world economic system, and
yep.
now, you know, we have one world, you know, a lot of one worlds. We have one world resources, one world
yeah.
stock market, one world, you know, everything. But you can't factor human consciousness into that. And this is where, this is one of the reasons, you know, Einstein, he died in 1955, a brilliant man, a frustrated man.
Right.
On his deathbed, his greatest frustration was that he was never able to unify all of the forces of physics into one story
right.
that's called the unified field theory.
Right.
So we have these four forces that are called gravity, electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force. They were, to this day, they have yet to be unified into a single understanding. And Einstein, he was so frustrated by that. The reason he could not unify those forces, and the reason that string theory and physics, for example, isn't working, it also is not...
No, my computer's about to fall down. It's okay. Now I'm going to put it back.
I thought maybe we were having an earthquake.
I know.
No, the reason is because the piece that has been left out is us,
yes.
is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the physicists that were working with Einstein, they said that that consciousness is the piece that's missing. That will I didn't want to go into a big long story, and I'm stumbling getting around, so I'm just going to say this. What the theories now are telling us is that we will probably never find the smallest particle of matter.
Right.
You know, we've got the CERN superconducting super collider, you know, in Geneva, Switzerland, smashing quantum particles, breaking them into a bajillion smaller pieces, looking for the ultimate
smallest
piece, and we'll never find it. And we'll probably never find the edge of the known universe. We've got the Hubble Space Telescope and the Chandra Telescope looking at the edge of the universe. And here's what happens. Every time those telescopes get to what they think is the edge, and we look a little closer, something else appears. And every time we find the smallest particle of matter, we say, oh, this must be it. Something else appears. And the reason is because human consciousness is part of these forces equation, of nature. The act
of observation.
The act of us looking with the expectation. This is the key. The act of us expecting to see a smaller particle of matter or expecting to see the edge of the universe is the impetus in physics that puts something there for us to see. It is the act of creation, the act of us emotionally expecting, the expectation that something will be there. We're actually collapsing space-time. We're collapsing the possibilities into a reality so that we can see what it is that we're expecting to see. This is something Einstein didn't like. I know most of our viewers have heard the quote, quantum theory says that you can influence matter from a distance.
From a distance, right.
And Einstein, he called that spooky action at a distance.
Right.
And he didn't say, I don't like spooky action. He said, if the universe actually works as spooky action at a distance, he said, I don't want to live in a world where that's the way it works. He didn't like that. He wanted it much more ordered. So that was his great frustration. And so for the scientists that follow that school of thought, they are refining to even greater degrees the wrong path that is keeping us from the unified field theory.
Okay, so
go ahead.
Okay, so let's.
I think we're told that's excited.
I'm excited. Okay, because if that were true, let's just say the average person that's watching you talk, right? We say, okay, then we can still apply that to our everyday lives and the way we think. And if we have, because a lot of people are saying, how is it possible that terrorism, for example, is causing so much trouble? Like, when shouldn't the good overrule the bad, right? That's this idea of separated. We're going to get saved by some nice God or whatever. And I'm saying, you know, because they expect this, they're organized, they're focused, they're reinforced, they reinstate, they you know, like it's this constant thing where then the field reflects back the result, right? So then the field can also, or your experience can be overridden by someone else's, just like prayer, or not the communion with the field or with consciousness can also affect, because at the core, at the very core, we life and love and the heart and creation, right? It is stronger than destruction.
See, this is where New Thought friends of mine often fall into an ancient trap.
Okay.
Because, and it goes back to something you said at the very beginning of this program, the field is a neutral field.
Neutral, exactly. It's neutral.
So it's not pulling for the light. It's not pulling for the dark. It is a neutral field that is reflecting what it is that we cast or that we project onto that field through choice. Sometimes they're conscious, sometimes they're not. So a lot of our choices are subconscious choices. There's a whole program we could do about that. But the point is that the field, it's not a biased field.
Right. So when I said that, here's what I want to clarify, right? Yeah. So when I said that, so this is where I get into arguments with other people too. It's like, because I believe it is impersonal, but that's why it's our, we need to be accountable so that when we are being, you know, called to fear, we have to do what we need to do. Like you said, understand yourself, understand that you have a responsibility for how whatever is reflected in the field, and make that shift. For example, doing these kind of exercises, plugging into the heart, plugging into the field. And then we can't even worry about what that is, right? So if enough of us, I go back to Bruce Lipton's, and you tell me if I'm wrong, Bruce Lipton's idea of the imaginal cells, for example, the butterfly, right? So we somehow ignite metamorphosis. If enough of us are doing this, then we are going to have, let's say if more of us is doing that and more of them is doing this, would you not say that that creation of that will override the thing over there? Or take its place.
Okay, it's all possible. Right. But the trap that so many fall into is we're still talking about a binary, about one versus another.
Tell me how to change that.
I don't know that we can necessarily change it, but that's the trap that we find ourselves. We're still fighting.
Right.
But we're fighting on a different level from that perspective. We've been conditioned to believe that time is linear. So in other words, it moves this way, and
left
what happened Yeah, what happens now is happening 5 minutes after 5 minutes ago. Okay, so that's the thinking of time. Time doesn't work that way. Time actually evolves in a spiral.
Fractal.
And the events within that spiral are fractal. So let me explain what that means. Time evolves, time moves, and physicists know this now. So this is part of relativity and all these other kinds of things. Time moves in a spiral. So let me give an example of what that means. An event that happens at point A in time sets into motion a pattern of energy that will repeat again and again as a cycle, as a rhythm, until something changes that pattern. So the key is the fractal nature of this comes in. Every time that pattern repeats, because the spiral is doing this, getting larger and larger, the circumstances will be amplified each time something repeats. So I know it's a huge concept, so let me just give an example. Say we're 5 years old. I use that age a lot for some reason.
We're all five.
So we're 5 years old, and in our family, we've got a bunch of brothers and sisters, and one TV set, and so Dad says, "Let's take a vote. Who wants to see, you know, what on TV tonight?" And if you're a girl and you've got four brothers, then the football game is going to win over the cooking channel, okay?
Right.
So your voice really wasn't heard and it wasn't considered. 5 years old, that's one way. The next time that plays out, and this actually has happened to a friend of mine. She was in the university. She was doing amazing graduate-level work. Her supervisor, the mentor, actually took her work, published her work, received the accolades for her work, but never gave her any credit for her works. Once again, her voice wasn't heard. That's the same pattern playing out on a bigger level. That's a fractal, that earlier pattern. She got married. In her marriage, she was never heard when her voice, what do you want for dinner? Do you want pizza or do you want a salad? You know, what do you want to see for TV? What are we going to do this weekend? She was discounted time and time again, to the point where her self-esteem was so low that she turned to chemicals to help anesthetize the pain from not being heard. So the point of this is it's the same pattern of not being heard when she was 5 years old, but each time that pattern played out, it's amplified. It's a fractal of that original pattern.
Right.
The reason I'm sharing that, what's happening in our world right now is a fractal of patterns that were set into motion.
When?
Long ago. So when we see the terrorism now that's happening on a global level, it didn't just crop up. That terrorist, the idea has happened on another level, another point in time, another level, another point in time. So the point is that these patterns will continue until something changes the pattern. They will continue to repeat until something changes that pattern.
What if we are the thing that changes?
Well, we have to be.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah, that's all there is. But the reason it's playing out on a large, people saying, well, God, you know, we've never seen terrorism like this before. It's a fractal of the terrorism we've seen in the past. Each time it repeats the cycle, it's amplified to a greater level or a greater degree. It doesn't have to be bad things. Let me give you a good example.
Let's give a good one.
I left home when I was young. I lied about my age. And got a union job before I was old enough to work in the union.
Right.
Because we needed the money. My family needed the money. And I remember sitting, I wasn't even 16 yet because I couldn't drive. But I was working in a factory where I was supposed to be 18 years old. I remember sitting there getting a paycheck every week, every Friday at the time clock, we'd get a paycheck. And it was a union wage.
Yep.
And I remember thinking in that moment, that feeling, and a man next to me, he literally, these words reverberate. It sounds sexist today, but what he said was, these are the words when I was, at that time I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
He said, a man's wage for a man's job. He said, you've been paid a man's wage because you did a man's job. Mm-hmm. that was important to me. That instilled in me a sense of success, a sense of abundance, okay? That sense of success and abundance stayed with me through my life. When I got my first corporate job, I was told I would never work in the corporation because I didn't have a degree. And I literally went down over the lunch hour with typed out, and that day is only a typewriter, resumes, and I distributed those resumes everywhere until some, and I kept doing it until somebody would call me. And when they called me without my degree, they offered me a job if I would go to school at nights and get my degree. That happened, and I've got something called a fractal calculator. It happened exactly on the repeat of the cycle of when I got that first paycheck.
I've used your calculator.
Okay, so my first corporate job was a fractal of that first paycheck. Yeah. My first corporate publishing with Random House was a fractal of that. My corporate with Hay House was my success and my failures in relationships. Every time I went through a failure in my relationship, it was right on one of those fractal points. So the point is that these patterns, we set them into motion early in lives, abundance, success, hurt, disappointment, betrayal, and they play out in our lives personally. The same thing happens on a global level. So what we're seeing on a global level right now is a fractal pattern of experiences that we saw maybe regionally or earlier in our lives. Those patterns will continue. They have to play out until something changes that pattern. And it may be at the level that our pattern is right now, we can change consciousness for the next cycle. But for this cycle right now,
So like if we were, so I want to go back to the idea, because I understand too the idea of the binary idea that when the minute we start to add the other in the equation, it becomes binary, us against them. If I do this, that will go away, whatever. So I have not all my thoughts are evolved, and I'm learning, and I change my mind because that's how it works, right? So I'm trying to find a way how to express this in a way that kind of doesn't look at that, you know, black or white, you know, but we do live in a dualistic light world, but whatever, that's the illusion. So let's say if we are immersed in protocols and life choices and learning about ourselves, not just about the ego self and the journey of the ego, but also learn about ourselves, learn that we are connected, learn that nature is connected to us, learn those things. Like I'm a walking miracle. I got clean and sober. I shouldn't be, you know, I'm in my Saturn return, my next planetary cycle, right? So I look again at, wow, look at these things that happened then. And here I am again in this new opportunity, blah, blah, blah. So, so I know that cycles are true and they work, but I think that, you know, it's easy for people to, when they hear that, to like, oh, well, it's a cycle, like that they'll go like, oh, okay, we'll just have to wait till it's over, where they think, oh, they can't be proactive, but we have to be proactive.
Sure. Right? No, we can. And the beauty of a cycle, we can make a choice anytime in our lives. The beauty of cycles is that when one cycle ends and the next cycle begins, there's a point in between where neither one exists. It's called the choice point. And when we can know where the choice points are for us personally or collectively, our choices become even more potent.
Right.
What I'm seeing right now, Colette, and I'm involved, I work with people at the UN, and I mean, there are a lot of very practical elements to the very esoteric things we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think our greatest hope, we have a new generation now that will be of voting age. These are young people, young teenagers that are now growing into adulthood, that simply worldwide. I'm not just talking about America, Canada.
Worldwide.
They do not identify with the patterns and the cycles of the past. And if we can instill in them the values, the deep truths of connection and cooperation to anchor what they are already doing intuitively. Okay, that's one piece. The other piece, can we make a choice at any point? The answer is yes, it's possible. Now, here's where the spiritual rubber meets the
rubber. Let's hear that. Yeah.
My experience is that the hurt, what I call the original hurt, is so deep, in the people that are fighting right now.
Yes.
It's very, very difficult for them to change.
Yeah.
All right. So whether we're talking about what's happening in the Middle East or Africa or, you know, whether we're talking about racially what's happening in North America, all these things right now.
Generations of hatred.
Okay. Yeah. So the generations that experience the original hurt, it's very difficult. It's possible for them to heal that. It's very difficult if they don't have the tools. So I think our best bet is if we can hold the war, whether it's the racial war that people are pushing for or whether it's the religious war that people are pushing for, if we can hold that at bay for just a brief period of time, just a few more years, then Buckminster Fuller said this very, very beautifully. He said, you're never going to change the world by fighting against the things that you don't like. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. He said, if you want to create true change, he said, find a new way to do things better that make the old ways obsolete.
Right.
When young people, young Palestinians, young Israelis, when they come together and they say, we're going to farm this land and feed our people, we're going to educate our children to love one another, that is not fighting the old way, that's choosing a new way. There's a huge difference between choosing a new way and fighting the old way. And when enough people begin that choice, the old way becomes obsolete, disappears. People say, another suicide bomb. Well, you know, well, what's that guy doing? You know, I mean, it's no longer support. And I think the same thing is true racially here in North America or anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. The young people, they want to create music together. They want to dance together.
Yep.
They want they're talking about having babies, and they want to raise their babies in a healthy world. And the world that has been created, the cycle that now playing out, that's coming to a close. As this cycle comes to a close, and we are literally living the window, it's about a 15-year window where one cycle ends that we're talking about now and the next one begins.
Right.
I talk about fractal time. This is the choice point. A new generation steeped in values that are true, that are based in the truths, the deepest truths of human existence, the values that we are unique, we are precious, life is precious. We are deeply connected to ourselves and one another through the field that we now exist, and that nature's based in cooperation. What would happen if we raised an entire generation of young people steeped in those beliefs? When they saw somebody, one of their peers, trying to do something the old way, they just laugh at them and walk away because it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So this is, I think, our greatest hope is to instill these deep truths in the new generation and hold the war. Not escalate, not respond,
just kind of go like this.
To keep people from trying to blow up the things that they don't believe in or that they don't like. Now, the cycles that we're talking about, conflict, this is fascinating to me. Conflict that many people feel is random, it follows cycles as well. Mm-hmm. And where we are right now, we happen to be, is it something called a 17.7-year conflict cycle.
Wow.
There's also a 56-year conflict cycle, and they're actually... there's a lot of study showing that they are related to solar cycles that influence our hearts and our brains. I mean, we could go on and on about this. The bottom line is that we are nearing the peak of a conflict cycle. 2017 is a peak. And then we begin going down the other side. And I want to be very clear. Just because we are in the cycle doesn't mean we must have conflict. What it says, Paulette, it says that we are vulnerable. We are susceptible, that this is a time to take extra special care when we communicate, extra special precautions to extend that olive branch and listen very, very carefully to what other people are saying, whether it's at the UN. Bruce Lipton and I just had the opportunity to share what I'm saying to you. We shared at the UN last fall because we are in this very vulnerable, precious moment. Where it's so easy. We are in such a charged environment.
Mm-hmm.
So easy for that charge to go the wrong way. So when we are conscious, this is the value of knowing the cycles. When you recognize the cycle, they say, "Well, my God, no wonder. Of course, here we are in the cycle." So when we can go that extra mile and take those extra precautions and listen and cooperate and make those extra efforts to do that,
yeah.
So we go over the hump of this cycle, then it becomes easier and easier. And the young people are now moving into the place where they have greater and greater power. This is why I'm so optimistic about the new world. All of this is possible because we are connected through a field of energy that is the container, it is the bridge, and it is the mirror for all things. And as we embrace that in our lives and apply it, it doesn't mean that things magically happen.
No.
It means we learn how to apply this in our personal lives. It is reflected in the world around us. And I think that's where we're going in our world. That's why I'm so optimistic about it. So I want to be here 200 years
yes,
to see how
I'm so,
it comes
and,
out.
And thank you. I think it's a great time for us to close the conversation because we ended on where we started. And this is in many respects, it is the thing that I talked about most in the book is that, you know, even, and I did it in a less scientific way, but the idea that this primary reality is all about connection and collaboration and radical
sure.
acceptance and trusting that being accountable, learning about who we are, our responsibility to one another, and bringing good into the world, but not denying that this other thing exists because it just does. Like you said, it's a cycle. And yeah,
it exists because we've created it.
We've created it, and it was based
consciously or subconsciously.
And I talk about. I actually have a class with Hay House called "Reprogram Your Subconscious Mind" about all the stuff that I had created with the Envision process. But you know, I think what you just said too about realizing that we are accountable. It's not like, oh, that over there is just happening. It's like that's over there because we set it in motion. So we also now have to be conscious to set something new in motion to the best of our ability every single day. Not to deny what goes on, but to know.
Well, sure. Every moment of every day, we are feeding this field.
Yeah.
And we're feeding by the choices we make in our living room and our interaction with our children, with our husbands, with our wives, with our partners, our coworkers. As insignificant as those experiences are, that is us energetically feeding a larger field.
Yep.
The question is, what are we feeding the field? Do we even know what we're feeding the field?
Yep.
How can we have a world at peace when we're raging at our coworkers or we're raging at our spouses or our partners in life, or we have such deep conflict within ourselves that we are anesthetizing that with chemicals, drugs, alcohol? All of those, as different as they are from one another, they are facets of us because there is no them and us. There is we, and we are always feeding this field.
And this idea of the hologram, because everything is everywhere, right? So the matrix is a pulsing, living, amazing map of the soul that, you know, if we step into it, it affects absolutely everything. Instead of this linear two, you know, like with time and space, it's everything is now, everything. If we want to create a different world, we have to create that world today and now.
We do, you know, and I realize it is a very different way for some people to look at the world. And what I invite people to do is this. Everything that you've ever done in your life, I'm speaking to our audience.
Yes, yes.
All of your solutions, the way you've dealt with problems all of your life, they've worked for you because you're here. Okay. And what we're talking about right now, I know for some people can be a very different way of thinking. I invite people to put what we're doing today in a little file folder called possibilities. Okay. That's all it is. Just filed away for possibilities. Next time something happens in your life and you've got to deal with it and you do what you've always done and it doesn't work, you can take a deep breath, a sigh of relief, let it go and reach for the possibilities because now we know. Science is telling us and confirming what our most cherished and ancient spiritual traditions have always said about the deepest truths of our existence. And when we can really get that, that's where this spiritual rock, this spiritual anchor really comes from. And that's what gives us the freedom to love fearlessly and to move into the new world and the new experiences in our lives.
You are so awesome. You are so awesome. This is so amazing. Oh my God, I'm so fortunate. And I know that you will have touched thousands and thousands of people with your words today. Greg, I cannot thank you enough for your time. I love you.
I'm honored. I could talk to you forever. I have another radio interview I'm doing here in just a few minutes. So that's why I'm going to say not goodbye. I'm going to say take good care. And I want to thank you for all that you're doing personally in your own life to feed the field with positive possibilities for all the people whose lives you touch. I want to thank the beautiful man you share your life with, because I was just filming with him recently, and the work that you guys do together. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in today and for listening. And Colette, send me a copy of the new book.
Of course I am.
I would love to see that book, okay?
Of course I am. Okay, love you tons.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Bye.